and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burge, and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. There's no set schedule. It's just whenever I finish a book, I do the review, and everyone can listen to it, hopefully, and enjoy it. And since the last podcast that I've uploaded, me and Juliana, my girlfriend, we've been heading off. It's been Christmas, and we decided to take a cruise together from Rome to Barcelona and back. And it's very handy that I work on cruise ships, and she came along with me this time. And we've had a really nice, very relaxing Christmas. Yesterday, I didn't have any work to do, so we pretty much laid in bed all day, went in the hot tub, and ate a massive meal in the evening, which was very good. Hopefully everybody else listening to this has had a comparably relaxing or interesting or enjoyable Christmas. And a Happy New Year to everyone coming up in the future. I might put out another podcast by the time New Year comes around, but we'll see how that goes. It's Boxing Day, and I've got a book to review. It's called Kiln People by David Brin. And this book is one of the most recommended books to me over the past few years. Loads of people have said, you're going to read Kiln People, Kimbo? And I finally downloaded it from Audible and gave it a listen and really enjoyed it. It's Kiln People. It was from 2002, written by David Brin. Like I say, it's probably over 20 hours or something. Let me just look on the goodreads.com page, and it says here 568 pages. So it's quite a chunky book. And I've seen it in the secondhand bookshop, but I've never really, I've not picked it up, and I was thinking, I'm not really sure. Strangely enough, at the same time, someone said, hey, you should read a book called Existence that came out, and that's really good. And so at one time, I managed to download Existence by David Brin and Kiln People by David Brin to listen to as an audiobook, not actually looking at the author, just going by the recommendation, and then both being books like, oh yeah, I want to read that sometime, and the other book, oh yeah, I want to read that sometime, and I just happened to have looked through or seen a recommendation on Audible or something like that. Anyway, so I decided to listen to Kiln People first, because it is an earlier work by David Brin, say from 2002, and the Wikipedia page here, which I brought up before, it says it has the distinction of finishing second in four different awards for the best science fiction fantasy novel of 2002. It came second place in the Hugos, the Locus, the John W. Campbell Award, and the Arthur C. Clarke Award. And each time it finished behind a different book. So I do actually like the idea of a book being well recommended as a second place book by lots of people. And that probably result in quite an interesting review or quite an interesting take on a book. So I do have things to say that I really loved about this book. And of course, other things which I really didn't love about the book. However, there wasn't anything that I particularly hated. But let's get on to the things that I really like. It starts really well. I love the ideas of this book. All the world building is really great, except that in some points it's not really great, but it's great. Like there's lots of holes in the world building. You think about it a little bit too much and you're like, wait a second, if this holds true and this holds true and this holds true, why isn't this a massive problem? If this is true and this is true, why isn't this like a massive area of opportunity? Or why don't people do this with what they've got? However, I don't really mind about that kind of thing, because it sets out the rules of the world and for the most part sticks to them really nicely. It's like, okay, this is what we're doing and this is the playground that we're in. There's other books which do this equally well. A book which I'll bring up, another well-known book from around about the same time, I guess, is Altered Carbon by Richard K. Morgan, and that's another book, very different in this in many ways, but quite similar in that it's also like a detective kind of story, like a noir style detective story, but it also treats the human brain or the human mind as something which can be transferred from body to body. And both of Altered Carbon and Kiln People have similar holes in them, like I say, that and they have to be kind of artificially held in status. The worlds that they're being that the story is taking place in, the world that is being portrayed, has to kind of be artificially kept it can be for story reasons or just within the story. It's like, now this is the way the world works, and we've reached this plateau of technology, this plateau of social adjustment, and it isn't kind of accelerating into the future towards any kind of any kind of singularity or anything like that. It's like, yes, this is it. And in this book, the part that I don't like is that there's like this commission. It's treated in the story as something that people know about, but there's like this commission for future technological breakthroughs that are going to be disruptive, and they have to be kind of like these new technologies have to be reported to make sure everybody knows what's coming in the future, and people can start. I think the idea would be that people can start like working out new business models and other societal kind of things. And I thought that was a little bit forced, like as a little bit like, hey, we've got this genie, it's out the bottle, now let's make a bigger bottle for the genie to be kept in rather than for it to explode. And but it's not quite putting the genie back in the bottle. It's more like, you know, releasing a new technology slowly. So, but in Kiln People, there is this kind of like set level, and society went through this massive upheaval about a generation ago. I'm thinking maybe like 30, 40 years beforehand is when everything kind of got sorted out. And now, I'm saying it's about that long beforehand because the people who were around who kind of made it like change society in that way by introducing the Kiln People technology, they're still on the scene, they're still around. So it must have not been too far, like too early or too far in the past from where this book is. But, you know, like I say, society's reached its plateau. And the idea being that a company called Universal Kilns sells a technology of Kiln People. And these are golems. These are clay people, which have got like a receptacle for the mind. And it goes zip, zip, zap. And you lay down on a table, zip, zip, zap. And your brain is copied across into the new person, this new kiln person, this new golem. And this golem is good for around about a day. And that when it comes back, it goes zip, zip, zap and puts its brains back, all its memories back into you. And so it has kind of continuation that way. And then the body, the clay body, just kind of dissolves away, and they send the clay body in a bin back to Universal Kilns, who then, you know, recycle it or reuse it or patch up or do whatever they can to get these golems recycled. And so this creates an interesting world where, like, the mind that you put across is like this weird soul, and you're like, okay, my soul is going across, and everyone has to have a kiln in their house, and you can only imprint one of these dits, as they call these dittos. You can only imprint a dit when it's laying, like, very, very close next to you. Also, you can only have your own memories implanted from your human... back into your human from your clay dit. So you can't transfer memories from one person to another. And all these kind of different roles. So variations of these kiln people, they're coloured in different ways to denote what their jobs are. But also you get these much bigger ones that you can put your brain into what they call a dino bus, which is like a dinosaur sized thing that carries other people, and you can carry people around. There's another one which is like a forklift. They call it a forklift. In other words, it's a huge big dit with a brain in it, and all it's used for is lifting heavy objects. And these dits are massive. They're as big as a forklift truck, or as big as a digger or something. And so most people just copy their dits in the morning, and they send out their dits, and the dits do manual labor or other not very interesting jobs. But, you know, it's enough for them to get paid. And of course, the dits get paid money, or the work that the dits do earns the original money. And the payment for the dit is that they get their memories inloaded back at the end of the day. Otherwise, they can just run off and do their own thing. And of course, that happens. You get the guys who the dits that you make, and they just go, actually, today I'm a dit. I've got my freedom. I'm not going to go back to my master at the end of the day. I'm just going to run off and do whatever I want. And these are called the Frankies, the Frankensteins, because again, they're a copy of someone that they lose control of. They go off and do the other thing. Of course, the people who are very talented, who have got a very good, an intellectual talent or a physical talent or some kind of talent which doesn't rely on, manual labor, they can imprint their minds into these other things. Say you're a scientist, it's great, because now you've got four scientists who are just as good as you to help you out through to the end of the day, who know just as much as you do. And then at the end of the day, you get all their new ideas back, and you can imprint into like a specialized thinking dit. So that's it. So these different colors. I'll get onto them in a minute when I get into the story. But yeah, I really like this idea, and thematically it works really great because it brings up all these questions of, you know, identity and all those other things, which science fiction is pretty much like. That's kind of the basic building blocks of science fiction, is to talk about what is it to be human, and how does changing what it's like to be human change society or change the world or change this or change that. So I get a bit more into that later on, but our story begins with Albert Brown, who is a detective, and he is a private detective, and he's got this long running feud. Well, not a feud. He's got his nemesis. His nemesis is called Beta, and nobody knows who Beta is, but he's a counterfeiter and he's a copyright stealer. So Beta steals dits from other people and then makes copies of copies, which aren't very good. But if you get a really a very good prostitute dit or a love dit or a good singing dit or whatever, you capture that and you make a copy of it. The copy is a good way. Of course, it's legal to steal copies, and there's lots of rules in how you're allowed to interact. Like dits and dits, they interact okay, but a ridge, which is an original human, a real human being interacting with any dit, he or she is a higher status than any of the dits at all. So dits aren't allowed to harm humans, but humans are allowed to harm dits. Dits are allowed to harm other dits, because if there's any dit on dit harm, it's just like a civil case, not a criminal case, and you just have to pay a fine and things like that. Anyway, so Beta takes advantage of this, of never really going against the law, and never really going against, you know, actually harming human people, but by counterfeiting the dits of other people. And Albert Brown is his, one of his long running jobs is to try and track down who Beta is. And that's how the book opens. A green dit, which is a low level, normally used for cleaning work around the house, and domestic worker dit is a green. And one of Al's dits is green dits. Is being chased through the city and through and up the river and trying to get back to Dit to get back to Albert to give him some information about Beta, which is going to be very interesting. So that's how it all starts off. And then, normally on the second chapter, you get in these detective kind of stories, like the main femme fatale comes in and it's like, okay, now I need you to sort this out for me. And someone's father has gone missing and Albert needs to sort this out. And then the father just turns up again and they're like, ah. And then it's like, oh no, the father's actually died. So it's not just a missing person query. It's now why did he die kind of query. So Albert prints off a whole load of his dits for the day, and he prints off two greys. And greys are quite high level thinkers. They're very, you know, they've got a lot of functions. They've got all their senses and they've got all the intellects there. So he prints off two greys and to go out and to meet up with these people while he goes get some rest at home. And he prints off a green as well, because the green needs to go and sort out some, you know, general domestic stuff. He needs to go shopping and do some of the deliveries. And he prints off one ebony, and an ebony is a highly they kind of like turn up the autism gene, the Asperger's syndrome gene. So the ebony doesn't want to go outside, but all he wants to do is sit in front of a computer and hack his way through different things. And this team of Albert plus his four dits, the two greys, the one green, and the ebony, we have like a huge part of the story told from all of their different points of view, and all of the whole book is told from the first person point of view, but the first person switches between different versions of this first person. And this is the thing that I thought was genius about this book, and really, really good fun, because the whole idea of, you know, the nature versus nurture, you can start off with exactly the same brain state or the same genes or anything like that, and then just changing what the different dits go through shows its different, character development throughout the day. So while there isn't a lot of, like, there isn't huge character development in the way that you'd normally get in a novel, where it's like at the beginning of the story the person is like this, and at the end of the story they've come to realize this, and they've changed in this way and they've changed in that way, and it's all like this big a big character arc, Here, you don't really get that because it's just far more subtle. It's like this character changes slightly and goes very slightly in this direction, and this other dit of his goes very slightly in this direction, and this other dit goes very slightly in this direction. So the contrast isn't between Albert at the beginning of the story and Albert at the end of the story for the purposes of character development. The contrast is between this version of Albert at the end of the story and this version of Albert at the end of the story. And some of them hold more true to the original Albert Brown, and others of them are, you know, further removed. Of course, the Green, his main story is that he becomes a Frankie, and Albert is normally very, very, very good at doing very high fidelity imprints or printing of into his dits, but the Frankie is just like, oh no, I'm gonna go and do my own thing, I'm not gonna be part of Albert anymore, I'm just gonna run around and do whatever. But the Greys stay more like him, and the Ebony stays at home, and he goes off, and in fact actually by the end of the book, and I don't want to do this too much of a spoiler, Albert Brown himself, his original, has actually changed further away from who Albert Brown is than some of his dits, and kind of needs to come back. You know, again, I don't want to spoil it too much, but the character development I thought was very interesting in this way. And of course, the voice work is really, really good too. I don't have the name of the narrator off the top of my mind. You can check it out on the Audible page, of course. But the way that he does the voices of these different characters is really great. The Greys kind of talk a little bit more like Albert's original, but a little bit more more formally, I guess, is the way to say. They have a more of a, like, oh no, I will do this. Yes, I will do this. And the Ebony is much like quieter. And then the Green has got a much higher tone of voice. I'm the Green. So he sounds a lot more innocent and a little less intellectual, a little bit more in touch with his emotions. So like the Green is a bit more like a happy dog. It's like, oh yes, let's go do this. Oh, I gotta go and do this. I gotta do this. And the Grey is much more like this. And then Albert himself ranges around and is the human. So I really like the splitting of the point of view into five different versions of the same character. Now, of course, this being a detective noirish kind of thing and science fiction, you know that there's going to be, and of course he's like the person he's trying to find is one of the founding members of Universal Kilns, who is very, very rich, who is very, very important. So, you know, he gets a lot of money in, and he needs to do this. He needs to work out what's going on, and of course there's going to be some kind of conspiracy here. And of course that's what it is. You, as the book goes on, you find another conspiracy, and you get the this is an opponent of Universal Kilns, and this is another opponent of Universal Kilns. You got like the, you know, the people who disagree with the kiln people, with the golems for religious reasons, and they don't think golems should be there at all. And then you've got other people who say, well, when you're a golem, you've got a soul as well, so golems should be treated more as humans. They should have more human rights, even though they're only going to last for a day. They should have more human rights and things. So and like you say, there's these different enemies. Well, not so much enemies, but like people who are counter to the goals of Universal Kiln. There's the copyright infringers. There's these other factors and these other people, you know, and all these different things. And these all kind of play into this conspiracy. And Albert is trying to get to the bottom of this conspiracy, and some of them, you know, so he solves these other things, he brings in these other things, he excludes these other things, and it's really interesting. And then as I was about, you know, getting to the end of, I think, or like the middle of part, that the audiobook was split into three parts, but I was getting to the end of this and I was thinking, well, this should just wrap it up about now, because all he needs to do is discover the identity of who Beta is, and that'll be the key to working it out, and that'll be the connection that he needs, and then he'll be able to discover why this guy dies, and that'll be it. He'll just wrap it up, and I was thinking, that's it. But then I realised that I still had about 10 hours to go, which, you know, in terms of the book, is probably about 250 pages to go if I was actually reading the book. Now, I'd been warned about this book, that it's a really good book, but loads of people say it gets stupid at the end. The ending lets it down. It's really good through, and then so I was like, oh, now I understand where it's going to get stupid. And it got to like that 80% of the way through, and I was like, oh well, maybe 75% of the way through, I don't know, but, and I was right, oh, I reckon it's gonna get stupid in this chapter. And then I was right. And again, it's one of those kind of things that you get to that point, it's like, no, we need new information to give us enough stuff to get through to the end of the book. And the new information was introduced, which was the identity of Beta and how that plays into it. And I was just like, that's really stupid. Why does they have to be this person? And you kind of were like, and of course, in hindsight, it's really obvious who it's going to be. Oh, it's not obvious, but like going by the economy of characters, you think, well, if Beta is going to like be revealed, it's going to have to be one of these characters who's already been mentioned in this book. And I was thinking, well, maybe it's Albert. Maybe it's Albert who's been Beta this whole time, and it's part of him, and he's been fighting himself. He's been fighting like a dit of his own, which was imprinted. Or maybe it's going to be the twin of this other character. Or maybe it's going to be one of the people who are running Universal Kilns, and maybe it's going to be that, you can only really go by the people who have been mentioned so far. And when it's revealed who it is, you're like, oh, and then you go, oh no, that's actually, like, in a little bit later, once it's explained a bit more, you're like, oh, that's actually really clever. And I wish that would have been the end of the book. Like, who is Beta? Like, who killed this guy? Or why did this guy die? Finish the book there. But kept on piling on the extra levels of conspiracy, which, again, I don't mind the conspiracies going about, but then it started introducing new science fictional ideas, new science fiction concepts in a way which kind of breaks it, kind of broke it all. Because, like, when you're reading a book and you're like, oh, this is like a noirish detective book, and by the end of it he's going to solve the crime and uncovered a potentially world-changing conspiracy. If that's the book that you set up at the beginning, which is the kind of book that I really like, and I don't mind that kind of stuff, like, say, Altered Carbon by Richard K. Morgan is the same kind of thing. He starts off, there's some kind of conspiracy, there's some kind of thing, he gets to the end, and he solves it, and he uses the new technology, the new science fictional ideas within the book itself to solve the mystery which is set up and exists within this world. But then, at the end of Kiln People, it doesn't do that. It changes direction, and David Brin is like, yeah, I could just write a normal noirish detective conspiracy science fiction book, but instead what I'm going to do is I want to write a big epic science fiction book. I want to write about the big ideas. I want to have these world-changing ideas. Even though we've got a world which is already set up, I'm going to devastate this world by what's going to happen, what's going to be introduced next. It's going to be amazing. It's going to be huge. And so it's like, why suddenly have aliens land at the end? Why suddenly have, go, oh, and now the singularity just happened. You're like, what? Or like, why? Oh, and it was all just a dream. Or he was dead all along. Or, suddenly time travel. And you're like, wait a second, time travel? And again, I'm not saying that any specific one of those happens at the end of Kiln People, but when you're reading a book which you just presume is a book about this one thing, and like 3/4 of the book have been like about this one, has been in this one style, about this same kind of mystery, about this same kind of conspiracy, and then at the end you suddenly go, and time travel. You're like, what? Wait, what? Time travel? Why is time travel suddenly being introduced at the end section of this book? And at the end, suddenly we're talking about God, and you're like, God? Why does God show up? What does God need with a starship? It's that same kind of thing. You're like, well, why? How does this suddenly fit? Why are these two books being jammed together in this way to the detriment of both? So I think this needs to be two stories. And again, to bring this back to Altered Carbon, I'm not saying Altered Carbon is a classic, but again, it was written about the same time and it's got these same kind of themes going on. But the good thing about Altered Carbon is that at the end, it doesn't break the entire world. At the end of it, like, the world kind of goes back to how it was. And then Richard Morgan writes the follow-up book, which is I can't remember the name of the other two books that take place after that. But in the next book, he goes to space, and there he meets aliens. And these aliens have been set up in the first book. They're mentioned that there's been aliens, and there's this other alien thing that you can't get off this world. And then in the third book, it suddenly becomes, now it's not so much. Oh yeah, in the second book, like I just say in this Altered Carbon series, it's less about the mystery and conspiracy. It's less of a detective, and it's more of an action. We're going into space, we're meeting the aliens, yay, that kind of stuff. And then the last book is much more of a a revolution on this planet, and is going to be this. So it, like, the, like, by beginning a new story set on a different planet with kind of the same rules, the basic rules, like the same minds swapping into different bodies, putting the mind into a different sleeve, which is a little bit like putting a mind into like a kiln kind of sleeve, but then exploring different ideas, he can then go, now I'm going to have the aliens arrive world-changing stuff. And now I'm going to have the time travel bit where this happens and this happens and this happens. But by separating that off into a different story, with hints in the earlier stories about big stuff that could happen later with aliens and all that kind of stuff, you're like, okay, well, that's great, because it kind of separates it off. And over the course of three novels, you can go from small conspiracy, personal story into world changing massiveness, in the same way like you read The Hobbit and it's about a dragon, and then you read Lord of the Rings, it's like, oh holy shit, this ring is really important, this is really great. But you know, The Hobbit helps play into the Lord of the Rings, or even in my my own fiction, you know, in this you know, these three novels that I wrote in the Minding Tomorrow series. The first one is just, you know, it's like a small thing, and by the end of it you're getting to like the massive world-changing events, and you know, destroying the world and singularity and artificial intelligence, all this different kind of stuff that goes on. But I didn't try and fit like smash them together into a single story. And that's what I think is the main downfall of this, is that you've either got to like set up a detective story that is that the detective and the conspiracy can be explained within the rules that you set up, at least in the first three quarters of the book. But then at the end, just to go, ah, and now we're going to solve that, discard all of that, don't worry about it anymore, and now we're just going to go into this, we're going to go on an epic science fiction quest throughout all of science fiction, and throw in the aliens, and throw in the time travel, and throw in the singularity, and throw in this, and throw in that, and by the end, it's just, I don't like it. However, the stuff that he does at the end, if it was in another book, I think I'd really enjoy it, because the whole idea of like, okay, souls exist, everyone knows souls exist, but nobody really understands them. So instead of just entering this conspiracy and this mystery, this detective, you know, this criminal problem, in the second book, if he'd have solved the idea of souls and done all of that in a second book, I would have gone with it and loved it. And I really liked the material that made up the end of Kiln People. All of that stuff that was there, and the journey that that Albert Morris goes on, and the other characters, and Ditz, and how it all comes together. I really enjoyed all of that as a different, if it would have been in a different book. But like I say, there's just smashed together. And by smashing together these, the ending feels overblown if you go by the tone set up at the beginning of the book. But if you then treat the tone of the whole book, like if you frame it in what happens at the end, it means that the first half of the book, or the first three quarters of the book, is just like trite. It's just like nothing's happened, like nothing of any note or anything that's worth even thinking about or considering is happening back at that beginning part. And so in preparation for this review, I looked at some, you know, a few of these Amazon reviews. And like when you get down to the 1-star or the 2-star reviews or something, it's like, you know, I started reading it and nothing was happening. Oh, but it really picked up at the end. And other people are like, oh, I really enjoyed the first part, and then it all fell apart at the end. And I think these two different views really shows the problem of this book, of the clashing nature. If you liked what's at the end, the beginning is just a slog to get through. And if you like what was at the beginning, the end diminishes what was at the beginning in a way which is tiresome. Anyway, so I think, as I mentioned before, the second place that this book got in all of these awards, in the Locus Award and the Hugo Award and the, what was the other ones? The Campbell Award and the Clark Award, all these, it's like he started off with one thing, aimed big, and then missed. And I think lots of people were voting for the first half of this book, and I think a lot of other people were voting for the second half of this book, but there was a lot of people who couldn't vote for either half because they were too much classing. So I think if he'd have just wrote a first half of this book, you know, then he could, and then release the second book the next year, he could have got two Hugos in a row, I reckon. You know, like, what's the Ender's Game and Speaker for the Dead? No, Ender's Game and Speaker for the Dead. Like, he had already got that. Two totally different books, two totally different tones of those books. But Orson Scott Card, he had an idea, and he played it through in the first book, and he had a second idea, and he played it through in the second book. I think if those two books had somehow been combined into a single novel, it would have diminished both halves and stuff. So that's it. I think that's pretty much all I want to say about this book. Like I say, I could talk about the themes, but I reckon if you read the book, I do recommend people read this book, but understand that it's two books smashed together. So once you get to the point where, I don't want to spoil it, but once you get to the point where real Albert reaches the battle arena, let me just put it that way, suddenly just like either just close the book for like 2 days and just go, okay, I understand now what's going on. I understand that we've pretty much solved one of the mysteries here. Then open the book again and read the next book, but kind of look at it in a different mindset and kind of separate it from it. And then, like, taking the ideas that happen in the last third of this book or the last quarter of this book as, like, a separate... Like, just treat it as a little novella based in the same world with the same characters and continuing the story off, but just kind of separate it from there. And I know this is a weird thing that I'm giving, like, how to read this book, do this and do this, but I just want to explain why... It's so great in so many ways, and the different themes that play together are so good. But I don't want to spoil the end of it by going too much into the themes at the end, except I really, really like the themes at the end. And I really enjoy the more human-level thematic explorations of identity at the beginning, but I don't think they fit together. So the thematic, even the thematic explorations are works really well. But I do want to say that I really like the way that our main character, you think he's going to be the good guy at the end, but then you realize he can also be the bad guy at the end. Like I say, there are different versions of him in the story, and at the end he might not be all of him joining together to fight against the good guy. Maybe he has become in some ways the bad guy, and I really enjoyed that aspect of it, that by just a very, very simple decision, or by like a little bit of facts coming in here and not coming in there, you can send someone down a different way, that he can either become the good guy, or he can become the protagonist or the antagonist. He can become the goody or the baddie, and that's really great. And finally, I just want to talk a little bit about the writing style of this. I really enjoy like the different voices of not just in the narrator, but the different styles of writing that come with these different characters, these different dits of Albert. However, my main problem with a lot of this is that all of these, we read along with all of these different dits and all these different characters, which is all the same character, and they all find out different parts of the conspiracy, and which I found very interesting. But they never manage to get back together to share their information with their other members. All the dits don't get back together again to say, hey, this is happening, and hey, this is happening over here, and hey, this is happening over here. Instead, we just read about them not knowing what's going on, and that did get a little bit frustrating. A lot of the times a character is going, well, I don't understand this, and I don't understand this. What's going on over here? What's going on over here? And we as readers know that another part of Albert already knows this. And for me, it got a little bit frustrating because I wanted to just go, okay, just say that I know that this character doesn't know this already. Don't have him spend, you know, a few minutes thinking about how he doesn't know something. And I think that kind of got it in a way a bit of the smooth and brisker storytelling, which I think would have been better suited for this novel, just to get it moving a bit. It's not a huge problem, but it did get, it's like, oh yes, and this character still doesn't know what this other character knows. And I'm going to tell you a few more times that this character over here still doesn't know what these other two characters over here. And we're going to have to go along with him as he tries to work out what you as a reader already know. And you're just like, catch up, Albert, catch up. It's a bit frustrating. The other thing that I liked about it, that I started to like about this story, but then got a bit annoyed with, that it was trying to... The idea that... let me put it this way. There's like a different way of working out what is going on. Like, how are we as the reader seeing this story? The most basic way of doing that is just go, yeah, but the narrator is telling this story. It's not the person telling the story. It's the narrator telling this story. And it doesn't matter what the characters are doing. We'll just look at them through the narrator's eyes, or we'll just have the narrator telling us this story. The narrator can be the first-person narrator. It doesn't mean that they're literally writing this story afterwards for us, and that's the whole thing. It's like, well, if you have a first-person, how do you know the person doesn't die at the end? Well, it's like, well, you can have it. You can have the person dying at the end. You just have to understand that they're not telling the story from the point of view of a person who survives the end sitting down and writing this story. And you can play with this in many ways, or, you know, authors do play with this in many ways, and like how to have a first-person narrator actually telling us a story. Of course, the one way to do it is by doing it with a diary, and another point is like, let me sit you down and I'll tell you the story of what happened. In this, it's decided that for the purposes of research and of Albert, the original Albert, knowing what's happened to his dits even if they die and can't implant their memories, is that they narrate what they are doing to a little non-electronic, non-biological, like little mechanical voice recording thing. And they can do it at super high speed. So they're like... And they do it like subvocally at that speed, which means then Albert can go back and listen to what these dits have been doing that day, even if they don't survive and he doesn't get their memories, he can still see it. So all the time the dits are trained, they have this impulse in them to narrate what they are doing for a future Albert. That's the idea. It gets a little bit... This storytelling idea starts off good. It's like, oh, I've got to do this. And this guy is walking, you know, at the very beginning, we need to follow this green as he goes in this river and he's not sure if he's going to survive. And he's telling the story. It's like, oh, I've got to do this. I've got to do that. And you're just thinking that, okay, this is good. So in the moment, you're narrating what you're doing and what you're saying. And because you're doing it at high speed, you can narrate faster than action is really happening. So instead of just saying what the other person is saying, recording what the other person is saying, you can also attach to it all of your thoughts, all of your ideas, all of your speculations, and lots of different descriptions of what is going on around. And it does kind of fall down a bit that the descriptions that these dits are saying, they're also describing world building stuff, which would already be apparent to Albert. Albert would already know the history of this person. Albert would already know the history of this. And these dits wouldn't have to explain all of that to Albert, original Albert, if original Albert is the intended, the implied or intended audience for what these dits are recording. And of course, at one point, the dits just think that the original has died. So it's then, well, now who am I recording for it? Well, am I recording it for me, or am I recording it for the police, for a police report later? Am I recording it for this? And it's never really cleared up. And then at one point, Albert is like, now I've got to make a report. And you're like, well, why are you making a recording? Oh, I've now got a recorder and I'm going to do this. But then Albert, because he's an original, he doesn't have the ability to speak. So he has got to do it at the normal speed, which means that he's got to have downtime in his story. And now he's like, oh, now I'm going back and I'm telling you this. This is what happens. So then that becomes more journal-like and more diary-like. And then when you get to the end, you're just like, well, why are any of these guys still doing this? And like, what started off as I thought was a very clever storytelling device weighs down the story, because David Brin thinks, I need to support this idea that these guys, so now I've got to find time for them to do it, or reasons for them to do it, and they've got to fit it into the narration that this guy is still sub-vocally recording what he's doing over here, and this guy is over here, and this people, and then you think, well, these people at the end, did we ever know what they were thinking? Because then the narrator, they're still the narrator, but we know that these minds don't get implanted back into Albert, and that Albert didn't have the recording, or why would he have the recording, you know, and all these different questions. So I think as a storytelling device, it works, or it could have worked, but by the end, the credibility is strained, so it actually starts detracting, because I started thinking, oh, why is this guy, when did this guy have a chance to dictate this into this little vocal thing? And then why is this guy, why are these people still talking about, why is this guy describing this thing here when Albert is standing next? Why is Albert in the same room as this person? Why are we seeing it from both their different direct points of view when the guy is going to have his memories in backloaded? And yeah, so when it gets to the point where the storytelling device, I'm trying to work out the logic of the storytelling device rather than just enjoying the story, it's in the way. It shouldn't have had that much impact on the story, even though I thought it was very clever at the beginning. So yeah, I think that's all I want to say. I think I've said enough. I think this book is worth reading. I'm going to give it 3.5 stars. I realize that on the rating on goodreads.com is 3.79 stars, and the friends, which are the listeners of the SFB on goodreads.com, give it 3.44 stars with, let me quickly just go back and check, because I made a note of that, and let me check. So 30 different people have reviewed it. Joel rated it 2 stars, did not finish. Isabel rated it 5 stars. Sandy 2 stars. Sylvain 4 stars, Odo 5 stars, Stuart, Chris, you know, 4 stars. So yeah, it's a variable ratings for this. So you could, if you start reading this and you really don't like it, I would say it's probably not worth going all the way through to the end. But if you like the beginning, I think you're going to come out of it thinking it's like a 3.5 star book, like I did. Let down mainly by the ending not matching up with the beginning, which is a real pity. So yeah, I think there's a lot of interesting stuff in this, a lot of interesting storytelling ideas, and the ideas of the actual golems as they run around and the society that it builds up, which I've not actually talked about too much in this story. And a very most of the like story points I've just left out completely here, but because I do think it's worth reading, and I want you to discover those by yourself. But like I say, this review has more been me talking about my reservations of this rather than the things I dislike. Because I don't think there's a lot to dislike about this book, but there is like I say, the tone clashes. So that's it from me. The next book that I read, I'm not sure actually, because I'm reading another author who's been recommended to me many, many times in books is Christopher Priest. People said read Inverted World, read The Prestige, and The Prestige is one of my favourite movies from the past 10 years, or favourite science fiction movies. I consider it a science fiction movie anyway, even though it is more a period piece and a mystery weird thing. It defies categorisation, I think, a movie like that. So I'm listening to the audiobook now. I've got about maybe a third of it still to go. Probably won't review that for the Science Fiction Book Review podcast unless people ask me to, because I don't really think it fits in with the style. Maybe I could talk about it a little bit, but it'd be very difficult to talk about it in a way which wouldn't spoil the movie. So if you're interested in my review of Christopher Priest's The Prestige, go watch the movie first and then tell me if you want me to talk about the book, or read the book first and then tell me if you want me. But I'll tell you this now, I don't want to take away anybody's enjoyment of The Prestige. And even if you like spoilers and don't like spoilers, I don't want to take away you guessing what's going on in The Prestige, or the fantastic feeling of feeling like an idiot, which you'll get like I did at the end of The Prestige. And I'm like, but anyway, I'm thoroughly enjoying The Prestige. It's definitely one of the best books I've read this year, although that said, might not review it. So I'll see what's going on in the future. We're going to review The Hobbit, me and Juliana. Juliana just finished it. She read the whole thing in 2 days. So we're planning on doing the Hobbit review in a few months' time, but it only takes a few days to read that book. So I might just read it over the next few weeks, and we'll do it. We'll do that review in January. Otherwise, thanks a lot for listening. You can check out my website, lukeburridge.com. I've got a blog there, which I've not been posting to too much, but I've got some original fiction, some novels that you can read for free, download them for free. There's some really good stuff there. What's up on audible.com? Oh yes, that's I almost forget it. Juliana just leaned over and said Audible. Yes, if you're interested in supporting the Science Fiction Book Review podcast, you can check out audible.com. go to audibletrial.com/sfbrp, or just follow the link which is on every single post of the every single podcast post on sfbrp.com. just follow that link there and check out a book from Audible for free. You can sign up for a free subscription, and every person who signs up for a free subscription with using the coupon code, let me put this, sfbrp, or going to that web address, that actually helps financially support. You can sign up for a 30-day free trial. There's 100,000 different books, and again, I'm a subscriber there. I really enjoy listening to the audiobooks there. Kiln People is really good value because it's quite a long book and it's got some really clever audio narration techniques. Or check out The Prestige. If you've watched the movie, check out The Prestige, the book. If you've not watched the movie, you could probably still thoroughly enjoy the book, although it is a totally different experience of listening to a book, of reading a book, of watching the movie based on the book. But yeah, I think it's a great service and it's totally worth it. And if you sign up via audibletrial.com/sfbrp, or go via the link on sfbrp.com, you can help support the podcast. Thanks, Juliana, for reminding me about that. I never keep it in my notes. That's it from me. Become my friend on goodreads.com so I can see what you think of books when I'm reading them. That's also really good too. And sign up for the SFBRP listeners group, and you can chat with other listeners on there as well. And email me, luke@juggler.net. I respond to every email, even though I'm a little bit behind at the moment because I'm traveling and it's Christmas, but I will get back to all emails. So any recommendations, any questions, any suggestions or anything like that, luke@juggler.net is the way to get in contact. Otherwise, thanks a lot, and I'll catch you next time.